in the Department of Psychology and Program in Neuroscience at the University of Toronto, Scarborough, and the Graduate Department of Psychology at the University of Toronto. He completed his clinical psychology doctoral degree within the neuropsychology track at Drexel University in 2008, followed by a clinical internship in the neuropsychology track in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago. He was a postdoctoral fellow in the Center for Cognitive Medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and also completed his postdoctoral residency in clinical neuropsychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. We are delighted to have Anthony presenting tonight on his research on cognitive functioning and functional abilities in BPD.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that beautiful introduction and for the invitation to be speaking with everybody here tonight. So I'm assuming everybody has their slides in front of them. And I'll do my best to let people know where I am as I go through the slides. So to get started, again, my name is Anthony Rocco, and I am a clinical neuropsychologist at the University of Toronto. And I'm going to be speaking tonight about something that is, you know, has been a really central aspect of my research program, which is understanding cognitive functioning in people with BPD. And although I'll be focusing almost entirely, I would say, on cognitive functioning in BPD, I do want to touch a little bit toward the end of my presentation on what we call functional abilities. So things like work and school and the ability to kind of do household chores, and how these might be actually linked to cognitive functioning in people with BPD, and also as part of the research that I'm doing now, looking at how these abilities might play out in relatives of people with BPD. So I think there's something in here for everybody. So going on to the next slide, slide two, in this presentation, I'll first be talking about what cognitive functioning is, then talking about how we actually evaluate cognition as neuropsychologists, why we think it might be important to study cognition in BPD. Then I'll get a little bit into what the specific findings have been when it comes to cognitive functions in BPD. And as I said earlier, then really touch on some of the new research that I've been doing looking at functional abilities in people with BPD and also their relatives. And then I'm going to sum up and describe kind of what are the overall findings that we now believe to be well established when it comes to cognitive functioning in BPD, and also discuss what I think are some really exciting future directions when it comes to cognition and other aspects of brain function in BPD. Okay, so on slide three, you'll see that I'm defining cognition, and you know, some people, you know, maybe think that when I'm describing cognition in BPD, that I'm referring to the DSM-4's construct of cognition, which usually refers to the way that people with BPD view themselves and view the world. In the context of this discussion, I'm really talking about cognition in the way that neuropsychologists define cognition, which is with regard to thinking abilities. So these are things like attention, concentration, the ability to remember things, and to problem solve. And so neuropsychologists are psychologists who have specific training to assess cognition in people who have mental and neurological disorders. So these aren't just people with BPD, but also those who might have dementia or brain injuries, other neurologic disorders. They use carefully designed instruments that have been validated on very large groups of individuals, if not hundreds, if not thousands of people, and they're used to measure various types of thinking abilities. On slide four, I have a little figure here, illustration of how there are a lot of different cognitive functions that are often evaluated by neuropsychologists. We can see things like attention, which, and all these I'll be describing in a moment, working memory, episodic memory, executive functions, visual spatial abilities, motor skills, and perceptual functions. And we presume, as neuropsychologists, that all of these functions are arising from the brain and how the brain and different regions and circuits within it are kind of working together to produce these specific abilities. Okay, so on the next slide, I talk about, or I get into, some examples of how it is that we actually assess these different cognitive functions as neuropsychologists. So slide 6 talks about attention and concentration. We actually know a lot about attention, and as neuropsychologists, we use specific tests to assess relatively discrete aspects of attention and concentration. One aspect of attention is brief attention. Sometimes people think that when we're assessing brief attention, we're actually testing somebody's short-term memory or memory, and that's another way to think about this. But it's by asking examinees, for example, to repeat a series of digits. So you can see that a neuropsychologist might be assessing brief attention by saying several digits, like 6, 4, 1, 9, 3, and then the examinee having to repeat those digits back to the individual who's testing them. So this is usually a pretty easy test for most people, unless people have very severe brain dysfunction. Where things get a little bit more complicated, and we tend to see greater difficulties in people who have attentional problems, are on tests of things like concentration, where we might ask somebody to sit in front of a computer and ask them to pay attention to maybe letters that are presented on a screen and then press a key only when they see a certain letter. So it might be the space bar whenever they see the letter A and not to press a button when they see any other letter. In this way, when we test somebody for as long as maybe 10, even 15 minutes, as they pay attention to things on a computer screen, we're actually able to assess somebody's long-term concentration, their attention, over a longer period of time. So I'm going to go through a few more of the different ways that we assess cognitive functions in BPD, and then I'm going to start to talk a little bit about why we assess these abilities in BPD and what the findings are up to date. Okay, so on the next slide, on slide 7, we see here the cognitive function of working memory. And we think of this as the ability to maintain and manipulate information online, kind of just in your head, for very brief periods of time. So not over long periods of time. So for example, you might ask, as an examiner, you might ask somebody to remember three words, like apple, table, and mouse, and then ask them to count backward by 5 from the number 76, then wait 10 seconds and ask them to remember the three words that you previously read to them. So they'd have to say apple, table, and mouse. And the idea here is that the person is going to be asked to remember and potentially manipulate the information online and then later provide that information. So working memory is a very complicated cognitive function, and we can be asking somebody to remember not only verbal information but also visual information. Okay, also a cognitive function where we tend to assess both verbal and visual information is when it comes to memory. And this reflects the ability to learn and to recall information. So verbal memory, as it says here on slide 8, it can be tested by asking somebody to remember a list of 10 words, and then after 20 minutes maybe asking the person to repeat the same list of words. Sometimes we ask somebody to learn information. It's not written on this slide, but we might give them 3 different opportunities to remember a list of 10 words. And in that way, we can assess how much information they're actually acquiring or learning over those 3 different learning trials. So we can also assess visual memory in a similar way. For example, showing somebody 10 designs, waiting 20 minutes, and then asking them to draw the designs from memory. And we know that verbal memory tends to be more represented on the left side of the brain, whereas visual memory tends to be more represented on the right side of the brain. All right, on slide 9, I talk about executive functions. These refer to really a number of different abilities, and you might have heard of this before if you've delved at all into the neuropsychological research on BPD. So executive functions are higher order thinking abilities. So they're not kind of relatively low-level abilities like being able to remember some digits or to, you know, recall information, which is still a pretty complex cognitive function. This usually revolves around, you know, these executive functions having to coordinate a lot of different abilities at the same time. So these are things like planning your behaviors, problem solving, and controlling yourself. So for example, this is a test that you can see here with these what are supposed to be pegs, and three different pegs of different heights, and then three different colored balls, and it's a tower test is what it's called. And what you would need to do on this test is you would start out with your board, which is on the bottom of the screen there, and you have a target board that you need to achieve, and you need to move those balls from one peg to another to make your board look like the target board, but by moving these balls in as few moves as possible, doing it as efficiently as possible. And some research that I published just last year has shown that really it's the frontal parts of the brain that are very much active and involved in this complex problem-solving and planning ability that's tested on this test. So I'll be talking a little bit more about executive functions later, because these tend to be the abilities that are most affected in BPD. All right, so moving on to slide 10, I want people to be aware that neuropsychological testing is used in everyday clinical practice, and we also incorporate it into our research. How do we use these tests in our everyday practice? Well, we can use these tests to aid in making a diagnosis, such as ADHD. You might imagine that people with ADHD tend to have difficulties with attention, especially the more complex forms of attention, like concentration and sustained attention, as executive functions. But also, we can use these tests and others that I haven't described to diagnose things like learning disorders or to differentiate among different forms of dementia, so Alzheimer's disease versus more of a different type of presentation with different types of causes. The other reason that we tend to use neuropsychological testing, and I found that this is a very common use in terms of people with mental disorders, is to use these tests in treatment planning. So, for example, if somebody's having a difficult time in therapy, whether it's somebody with BPD or another mental disorder, maybe there's a cognitive deficit that might be interfering with their ability to benefit from treatment. So we might find that cognitive testing or neuropsychological testing identifies a need for memory aids or to reinforce certain information in psychotherapy, or for people who are taking medications to alert us to the fact that somebody might need assistance in remembering to take medications. So these are just two of many different reasons that we use neuropsychological testing in clinical practice. Okay, on slide 11, I want to start addressing the question of why is it important that we even evaluate cognition in BPD? So historically, if you look at some of the writing that people have done who have been very experienced in treating people with BPD, some clinicians have described a variety of cognitive deficits or neuropsychological deficits that seem to interfere with the treatment of some people who have BPD. So Jerome Kroll in 1988 talked about a number of different cognitive deficits that he suspected in people with BPD. That's on the next slide that I'll get to in a moment. But more importantly, the research that has been really published over the last decade or so has started to show that difficulties with cognitive functioning in people with BPD, that they tend to be associated with higher levels of inpatient psychiatric hospitalization. And in a more recent study, researchers have found that there's a greater likelihood that people with BPD who drop out of treatment may actually have cognitive deficits, and specifically in these higher order executive functions that require really a great deal of thought and cognitive ability. So on slide 13, you'll see kind of what has been described in the past, at least in terms of people who work with people with BPD. So we're talking about things like difficulties with logical reasoning. We like to think about this as a form of problem-solving ability. You can also see that people have described problems with poor focus and concentration, which I actually hear quite a lot about that from people with BPD, both when I go and give talks like this to people in the community, but also in clinical practice. Memory problems and memory distortions, so difficulties recalling information or recalling information in a way that isn't entirely accurate. And then, of course, impulsive behaviors, which we know is one of the diagnostic criteria for BPD, but we also know that impulsive behaviors can really run the gamut. There's so many different ways that somebody can express impulsive behavior. And neuropsychological testing is actually used to evaluate all sorts of different impulsive behaviors, and we'll be talking about that in a moment. On slide 14, this is probably something that won't be a huge shock to people who have BPD, to parents who have a child with BPD, and that is that ADHD is considered, in childhood, is considered a risk factor for BPD in adulthood. In general, we know that ADHD and BPD actually share a number of symptoms. So just by looking at the diagnostic criteria, impulsive behaviors are common in both disorders, as well as emotional instability and difficulty controlling anger. Some of the measures, the questionnaires that we use to assess ADHD actually also include difficulties with identity, which we know is a component of BPD. So it's interesting how these symptoms tend to correspond between the two disorders. And as I said, children with ADHD are 5 times more likely than children without ADHD to develop BPD later in adulthood. So as I'm sure will not be a surprise to many people who might be listening, ADHD and BPD tend to show some relationship, and many people with BPD will also meet criteria for ADHD. Okay, on slide 15, I'm going to start to talk about what does the research say about cognitive functioning in borderline personality disorder. Before I actually describe what the results of these studies suggest, I want to start out by really stating some cautions for people who might be wanting to interpret what these findings might mean. And really, I came up with these precautions based on a lot of questions that I've gotten in the community in terms of what they might mean for individual people with BPD. So if we go through these one by one, the first one that I want you to keep in mind when interpreting the results I'm about to present is that not all people with BPD have cognitive difficulties. So not everyone looks like this. These results present the averages of how people with BPD perform on these standardized tests of cognition. And as I mentioned earlier, these tests have been given to hundreds, if not thousands, of people to understand how the typical person performs on these tests. So these are averages that I'm going to be presenting. Some people with BPD have difficulties with many cognitive abilities. I can say in my experiences, I've seen people who have very severe memory difficulties and attentional difficulties. But I would say it's just as frequent that I see that people with BPD have average or even superior abilities in cognition, in certain cognitive abilities. So be aware that there can be a lot of variability, not even within an individual person, but also across people. There may be many reasons that a person with BPD may experience cognitive difficulties. It could be related specifically to what we think might be some of the brain dysfunctions that go along with BPD, but it could also be associated with some of the symptoms or problems that tend to also be seen in people with BPD. For example, maybe if somebody is taking a sedating medication, so that could definitely influence somebody's cognition. Fatigue that could be caused by poor sleep, and other physical and mental disorders, including people with BPD who might have a history of head injury. They might actually have even more significant cognitive deficits than the average person with BPD. So I'd like people to keep that in mind, that there are lots of different potential reasons that these might be present in any one individual. And finally, understanding what might be a significant or a problematic weakness in cognition for any one individual should be made in consultation with a psychologist or neuropsychiatrist with expertise in neuropsychology or cognitive functioning. So I wouldn't want anybody to extrapolate from these findings that these are potentially problematic for you, but instead to consult with, you know, a licensed professional to make this type of a determination. Okay, so now that I've stated all of the precautions, let's get right into it. So on slide 17, I want to start out just by talking about, on one level, what do people with BPD and even their relatives say about their own cognitive functioning? Not even using these tests that I described earlier, but just based on their own reports of cognition. So my colleagues and I published this study last year in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry. And what we did is we looked at a number of different measures or scales that are examining actually ADHD symptoms, so things like inattention that you'll see along the horizontal axis at the bottom there, hyperactivity, impulsivity, and self-concept. And what we did is this is part of a larger family study that we are conducting at the University of Toronto, where we're looking at people with BPD, which are the green line or probands, and we had 26 of them in this particular study, their first-degree biological relatives, which we have 17 of them in the yellow line, and then controls, which were people who didn't have any history of mental disorder, were the blue line along that zero axis. What we found is that people with BPD, the green line, reported very, very strong levels, high levels of difficulties with inattention and forgetfulness, which is that first scale that you see along the bottom, along the horizontal axis, as well as hyperactivity that we see in ADHD, obviously, and impulsivity, the ability to control your behavior. So these may not be surprising to people, but especially for people with BPD. But what was interesting to us is that the yellow line, which represents our relatives here, who don't, by the way, have any history of BPD, bipolar 1 disorder, but did have a history perhaps of depression or anxiety, that relatives of people with BPD actually do report an elevated level of cognitive difficulties, as well as other difficulties that we actually see in ADHD, like hyperactivity and self-concept difficulties. And the red line that you see on there along the one, along the left side there, where you'll see the one, that actually is a rule of thumb that about a one standard deviation above the mean there usually represents a weakness, kind of an objective weakness, what we would consider would be the point where we say that this might actually be a difficulty in somebody who's reporting this level of difficulty. So the long story short that I'd like you to take away from this slide is that before we even get into our tests that we use to assess people's cognitive abilities, we can see here that people with BPD and their relatives actually are reporting that they are experiencing cognitive difficulties, especially with attention, forgetfulness, and impulse control. So if we go on to slide 18, I also want to put it out there that many people have suggested when I present these results that people with BPD, maybe they're just not trying on the tests that we give them, which I guess is a valid concern, because anybody that we test on these specific standardized instruments could simply not be trying, and that could influence their test scores. On this slide, what you're seeing is that along the bottom where you see compliant, which is the number of people with BPD that we found are compliant among a total sample of 50, we found that 44 people with BPD on our random sample of 50 people that we tested actually are trying on the testing. So, you know, a good number of people are putting forth effort on our tests. About 1 in 10 might be questionably or probably not compliant on our testing. So we know that the vast majority of people's BPD are trying on our test. And you might be wondering, well, how do we evaluate trying? We use these standardized instruments that I can't really talk about too much in public because they're protected in terms of how they work. But what I will say is that they're very well known and validated tests, and that our findings using this test actually suggest that the vast majority of people with BPD are trying on testing, and that for those small groups of people that are not trying, that six people that we identified in our group of 50, that only the one cognitive function that seems to be scored less on, or scored, people aren't trying as much on, is on tests of response control or impulse control. So we need to just be very careful that if we consider that some people might not be trying, they may be trying the least on tests of impulse control. So overall, I want people, though, to understand that in general, we can trust the findings that we get from our neuropsychological research. Okay, on slide 19, I actually am presenting the study that I'm probably most well known for, which is a meta-analysis that brings together the results of several studies on neuropsychological functioning in BPD. I published this now a decade ago, and I know there's actually a new study coming out that's very consistent with this, an update to the study. What I found is that people with BPD do have cognitive deficits, and that they do affect a range of cognitive abilities. If you take a look at this graph, what you'll see is that I tested a number of different cognitive domains, things that we've talked about, attention, processing speed, how quickly can people process information, verbal memory, visual memory, visual spatial abilities, their ability to change their mind and be flexible, and planning abilities. Now, this put together findings across 266 patients with BPD and about the same number of healthy controls. And what I found is that all of these deficits that you see here are statistically significant, meaning that people with BPD do perform worse in all of these different cognitive domains as compared to controls, and that in particular, those cognitive domains that seem to be quite problematic, where we again see this weakness line, are in the areas of visual memory and planning ability. And this has caused some people to suggest that perhaps the right hemisphere of the brain is more impacted in people with BPD because visual memory appears to be more significantly affected than verbal memory. And this also has been suggested by some people to represent maybe an increased likelihood that people will have a nonverbal learning disorder. And people also think that maybe because emotions tend to be associated with right hemisphere functioning, that this might represent some type of right hemisphere of the brain, this some type of dysfunction in that region. Now, something that's probably not surprising are these planning abilities. And what's interesting, I think, about these findings is that this research suggests that we can actually use tests where we ask somebody to create a tower, like I just showed you, and we can actually see that people with BPD are not taking time to plan out what they're going to do on these cognitive tests. Okay, on slide 20, I want to highlight some new research that's coming out that goes beyond just looking at certain cognitive deficits in certain skills, but also highlight that people with BPD are actually starting to converge in terms of their findings on cognition with other mental disorders, so those with schizophrenia and depression. And what this finding is that people with BPD may also have greater variability in their cognitive abilities. So even though I've showed you that there may be certain cognitive abilities that are particularly difficult for people with BPD, there also is research that's suggesting that if you compare these different cognitive abilities within any one individual, there's a huge range of variability. And so, for example, even on a test, for example, of attention, we find that people are very variable. People with BPD are very variable in how they how quickly they even respond to something that shows up on the screen. I've actually just published a study last year looking also at memory functioning in people with BPD. And what I found is that people with BPD show very large discrepancies, actually, on our tests of verbal and visual memory. And even though they show large discrepancies, and we expected that visual memory would be the worst, given the research I just described, we actually found that neither one was actually consistently better or worse than the other, but instead that there tend to be whopping differences between verbal and visual memory, far more than would be expected in the average population of people in the United States. So not only are we starting to see research that suggests that there might be specific cognitive deficits that characterize the average person with BPD, but that there might be a great deal of variability in cognitive functioning within individuals. Okay. Now, research that Greg Williams, one of my graduate students that I worked with recently, we started to try to understand how it is that cognitive functioning might be related to some of the more potentially serious, medically dangerous aspects of BPD, and that relates to self-harming behavior, self-injurious behavior, and we're talking specifically about physically self-injurious behavior, so things like cutting or burning oneself. So we tested a number of people, 58 people with BPD here in Toronto, and what we found was that if we can evaluate how medically lethal or severe somebody's self-injurious behavior has been in their life, so some people will say that they perhaps have, you know, physically cut themselves and that they bled very minimally and that they didn't require medical treatment, but we've also seen people who have engaged in far more medically dangerous behaviors, so people who have overdosed on medications and have gone into comas. What we found is that people with BPD who have actually engaged in those more lethal self-injurious behavior have poor executive functioning. One of the things that you, the graph that you see here, what I'm presenting are three different aspects of one test. This test that people may have seen before where you have to read colors, color words like blue, green, red, and eventually you have to say the color of the ink that a word is printed in, ignoring the actual word that's written. It's something that a lot of people have seen before. It's called the Stroop test. What we find is if we ask somebody to just name colors, there's no difference between very lethal patients and less lethal patients. You can see that difference, that green bar is very small. If we ask them just to read words of colors, the difference, you know, is still somewhat minimal and not different between those highly lethal and less lethal patients. But if we now get to the point where somebody is going to have to ignore the tendency to want to read a word, but instead name the color of ink that a word is printed in, we see this, the part of the brain that normally lights up when they're having to inhibit this tendency to read a word is in the frontal lobes. And what we're seeing here is that that ability to control your behavior and to actually stop yourself from reading the word rather than naming the ink, people who had more lethal histories of self-injurious behaviors, they actually did much worse on this test. That's a statistically significant difference. Not only did we see that they had a harder time with inhibition, but more highly lethal self-injurious patients also had greater difficulties on a test of problem solving. They're actually less efficient on tests of problem solving. They actually made lots of errors and had a more difficult time figuring out certain problems. So overall, what this suggests is that we might be able to discriminate among different subgroups of people with BPD who maybe engage in more dangerous self-injurious behaviors based on neuropsychological or cognitive functioning alone. And it's interesting that the people who are doing more dangerous things to hurt themselves are showing difficulties on tests where they need to control their behaviors, control their impulses, and also problem solve in a more efficient manner. So you can start to see how we might be able to use neuropsychological functioning to better understand different aspects of BPD as well. Okay, on slide 22, I want to highlight some of the new and emerging research, which is that cognitive deficits, such as the ones I just described, may actually run in families with BPD. So we recently showed, myself in collaboration with some of the better-known people in the BPD world, Mary Zanarini, John Gunderson at McLean Hospital in Boston, we recently published a study showing that these complaints of cognitive disturbance, the types of things I talked about earlier in that very first graph, where people will talk about having difficulties with attention and forgetfulness, and other aspects of cognitive dysregulation, as they call it, these might actually run in families with BPD. And this is in a very large family study run in Boston. And that difficulties with cognition seem to be specifically segregating with the disorder, meaning they're specifically associated with the disorder as opposed to maybe being associated with depression. They're actually specifically associated with BPD. And in a study that I published a few years ago now when I first arrived back in Toronto, was that first-degree relatives of people with BPD, and this was a study with Joel Paris at McGill University in Montreal, that these first-degree relatives, in this study it was sisters of people with BPD, may be at risk for deficits in executive functions, especially in planning and response inhibition. So we're starting to see that maybe there could be a familial and maybe a potential genetic component to these cognitive deficits. Okay, on slide 23, I'm getting into the section talking about functional abilities, and then later I'll be starting to relate this, at least in a preliminary way, to our findings on cognitive function in BPD. On slide 24, you'll see that there are many different ways that we measure functional abilities in people with mental disorders. Sometimes you might hear this as functional disability, functional impairments. What we're getting at are a number of different things that are happening in the everyday life of an individual with BPD. So how might BPD and the symptoms associated with BPD affect things like the ability to work and sustain employment? Interpersonal relationships, how might the disorder affect family, household responsibilities, academics, the ability to actually engage in recreational activities, physical functioning, vitality, self-esteem, relationship to the self, the ability to provide for oneself economically, and also just basic mobility and the ability to get around. So this has been studied in BPD in the past. On slide 25, you'll see that functional limitations in many different ways, some of these are described on slide 24, they are common, or at least commonly reported by people with BPD. So individuals with BPD report greater disability than people without BPD, even when you control for socio-demographic characteristics, so you know what somebody's income or the area in which they're living, even when you control for physical conditions or other mental disorders. Patients with BPD and those with schizotypal PD report more impairment at work, in social relationships, and at leisure than certain other personality disorders or in people who have depressive or anxiety disorders. And these functional impairments, especially when it comes to social relationships, are relatively stable at multi-year follow-up assessments. That even if you assess somebody with BPD 5-10 years later, they tend to persist, these difficulties. So trying to understand the source of these difficulties is a really important task for researchers in who are studying BPD. On slide 26, you'll see that the newest and the way that we assess functional limitations, or here you'll see we call it disability, and this is actually recommended in the DSM-5 as a standardized way to assess disability in mental disorders, it's to use this measure called the World Health Organization Disability Assessment Schedule, or the WHODOS. Now, the WHODOS is a measure that actually examines functional abilities in six different areas. The first we consider to be cognition, actually, so understanding, communicating with other people. The next is mobility, or getting around. The third is self-care, so can you actually, take care of your everyday chores and clean and things like that. Getting along with other people, this is kind of the social interpersonal component of somebody's ability levels. Another one is life activities, like your household chores, your work, your school. And then finally, your participation in society. Another way that we can think about this is, have people experienced discrimination or stigmatization due to their mental disorder, and how often are they able to participate in community activities? On slide 27, and I actually presented this at NASPD, the North American Society for the Study of Personality Disorders in Boston last year, and it kind of shocked people. And what this slide is saying is that people with BPD are actually reporting on the HUDOS extremely high levels of functional disability. It was actually higher than I'd expected. The average person, so this is across 43 people with BPD who are outpatients, okay, not people who are in inpatient hospital, but actually outpatients, on average, they're at the 90th percentile. So compared to most people in the world, because this has actually been used on literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world, we know that they actually, the average person with BPD is reporting so much functional disability that they're reporting more disability than 90% of the population. And that's the average person, outpatient with BPD. So this starts to tell us that there is something very significant going on here, and it's important to try to understand what might be the reasons for this type of disability. On slide 28, you'll see that there are different ways that cognitive deficits might actually affect someone's life. So, for example, different cognitive abilities could impact the ability for somebody to be able to care for themselves, to communicate effectively with other people, and to carry out one's daily activities like work, school, and household responsibilities. On slide 29, what I'm showing you here is the results, the initial results for our family study of BPD. What you'll see are the different HUDOS scales that I mentioned earlier along the horizontal axis, so cognition, mobility, so that's literally the ability to get around physically, self-care, social interpersonal abilities, life activities, participation in society. Along the vertical axis is how severe the disability is that's being reported. Now, I won't get into details of what those numbers along the vertical axis mean, because they actually don't have any inherent meaning in this context. But what I will say is that the people with BPD who are in blue are very significantly elevated. They're reporting very high levels of disability across all of these domains, but especially in social and interpersonal relationships, their life activities, and their participation in society, and then less so, but still elevated, in cognition, mobility, and self-care. And it was actually surprising to me that people with BPD would report such high levels of disability when it comes to literally the ability to get around. And our analysis suggests that this is not just related to social avoidance and withdrawal, but there might be something else going on here. And I've heard a lot of different suggestions, maybe related to medications and other types of physical limitations that people with BPD might have. The other really striking finding is in that, again, in our sample of relatives, this is, again, 17 first-degree relatives, none of them had major mental disorders, so like BPD or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, but still significant difficulties with depression and anxiety, that relatives who are in yellow actually report an intermediate level of difficulties in all of these domains. The only one that's actually not different from our controls, who have no mental disorder, is the domain of self-care. So what we're seeing here is that not only do people with BPD report significant functional disability, but there's also an elevated risk of disability among just by virtue of being related to somebody with BPD. And of course, there are lots of different ways that we can think about this in terms of familial interactions. Many of these people, I should say, about a half of them were parents. Another, I would say, 40% were siblings, and there were only a very small number of children of people with BPD. So this is largely pertaining to parents and siblings. Okay, on slide 30, I want to get the point across that problems with attention and memory might actually be linked to difficulties with activities of daily living in BPD, the types of things that we just talked about, this functional disability. In our research published recently in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, we've shown that even if you consider and control for depressed mood, complaints of inattention and forgetfulness are still associated with reported difficulties in carrying out activities of daily living in BPD and relatives, so work, school, and household responsibilities. So given that these types of cognitive deficits, so deficits in attention and memory, tend to run in families, it's interesting that these deficits seem also to be related to difficulties in everyday living, especially with work and school and household chores. So our research moving forward is continuing to assess this potential question and the link between cognition and functional disability, functional limitations in people with BPD. And in research that I'm just starting to look at, this is very preliminary, among patients with BPD but not relatives, we're starting to see that greater difficulties with social functioning in particular are associated with deficits on measures of attention and speed of information processing. So what these mean, really, these associations, what they mean isn't really clear just yet, and this is the research that we're continuing to study, and hopefully I'll have an update in a year or two. Okay, on slide 31, I want to talk, and actually 32 technically, I want to talk about how we can summarize the research that I just presented. So first, on average, people with BPD do tend to show subtle weaknesses, although there will be some people who have far more significant weaknesses and others who don't, in certain cognitive functions. And those that tend to be most significantly affected in people with BPD tend to be things like attention and concentration, memory, and executive functions, in particular planning, problem solving, and impulse control. And in addition to these weaknesses in specific cognitive functions, when you compare different people with BPD, and even within any individual person, there appears to be a high degree of variability in people's cognitive abilities. So some people might have strong verbal memory, but weak visual memory, and vice versa. And this is quite consistent with findings in other mental disorders like schizophrenia, depression, and ADHD. And more severe deficits in our most recent research, more severe deficits in impulse control and problem solving might be related to how severely an individual with BPD injures themselves physically. And so we're starting to link these cognitive abilities with potentially important features of the disorder. On slide 33, you'll see that individuals with BPD and their relatives do report elevated functional limitations across a range of life areas, and that these limitations may be linked to difficulties with attention and problems with forgetfulness. And that's not just in people with BPD, but also their relatives. Now, if we think about what this all might mean for treatment, you know, we know this across other disorders and research in other disorders. It's suggested that to effectively engage in psychotherapy, people need to have intact attention, concentration, memory, and executive functions. Psychotherapy is a pretty complicated process. You know, trying to understand abstract and conceptual things like mindfulness can be difficult. And so it's important for people to be able to plan their behaviors and problem solve. Actually, some therapies are specifically focused on problem solving ability and impulse control. Problems can arise in therapy when any one of these cognitive functions is affected. And so it's important to realize that if one of these things is not very strong, and in fact, if it's quite weak in people with BPD, it could have some downstream influences on therapy outcomes and functional abilities. And this actually, I didn't describe this in our future directions, but along with Shelley McMain at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, we're actually testing as part of a very large-scale dialectical behavior therapy trial. We're incorporating neuropsychological measures of attention and concentration and impulse control to understand whether people who have difficulties in any of these cognitive abilities might actually show poor outcomes in treatment. On slide 35, you can see that maybe there are aspects of treatments, especially those that integrate mindfulness, that can improve cognition in BPD. The theory, at least, according to this slide, and and people who have written about this, is that practice and mindful awareness and acceptance can improve somebody's attention and concentration and their impulse control by making them better aware of these tendencies. And that as a result, there might be a better capacity to benefit from treatments and improve functional abilities. So we're still trying to understand how it is that we can improve these abilities, not just potentially with medications, which is what we tend to hear more about with ADHD and other cognitive disorders like schizophrenia and dementias, but also potentially to be using psychotherapy. Okay, on slide 36, you'll see that there are a number of what I think are very exciting future research directions that are, and these are studies that are underway in my laboratory to investigate many compelling questions about cognition and BPD. As I said, there's this treatment trial and other research that we're doing right now that's looking at how cognitive limitations might impact psychotherapy outcomes for patients with BPD. This is very active research that we're doing at the moment to look at whether cognitive deficits might be used as potential biomarkers to identify genetic factors that might be causative in BPD. We're also looking, as I said, at cognitive deficits and the extent to which they might be inherited in families affected with the disorder. How might cognitive limitations impact functional abilities in people with BPD and their relatives? And then some very new research that's funded by a foundation in the United States called the Brain and Behavior Foundation is a study that I'm doing here in Toronto looking at a new brain stimulation therapy that is meant to improve depression and might actually have impacts on cognitive abilities as well. So we're doing a number of different interesting new studies to better understand cognition in BPD with a number of different takes on this, genetics, functional abilities, and even different ways that we can improve cognition in BPD. All right, and that is everything. On slide 37, you'll see my acknowledgments. University of Toronto, of course. I have a very active laboratory of students who contributed a great deal to this research. A number of different people in Canada and in the U.S. have also contributed to this work. Paul Links at Western University, Shelley McMain at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health here in Toronto, and John Gunderson and Mary Zanrini at McLean Hospital. And of course, I need to acknowledge the people who fund this work, which are the Canadian government, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation. Thank you. So I'm not sure how things work now, but I'm not. Is it possible to take questions from people?
Oh, Anthony, it's Perry. No questions have come in, I think, because you've done such an outstanding job. Thank you so much. This was so comprehensive. If we get some questions that come in after the hour, is it okay if we forward them to you and perhaps post them on our website?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Okay. Well, thank you. Elena, are you there? Oh, I don't know where. Let's make sure she didn't end up on mute.
Hello?
Yeah, Elena?
Oh. Hi. Yeah, thank you so much. That was a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll have it posted on our website hopefully in a few days, and we hope to see you at the NASSPD conference, Anthony. Will you be there?
I have to actually attend a suicide conference around that same time. But I will be there the following year.
Okay, wonderful. We also want to thank the Gunderson residents and Clearview Treatment Programs for co-sponsoring these calls so that we have the resources to post them up on our website. And thank you for those of you who have sent in money tonight to help support that effort as well. So thank you to everybody. Elena, thank you. And Anthony, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Perry.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Good night.